This podcast is brought to you by Price Bailey. Whilst the topics discussed in this podcast reflect our expertise and experience, they do not constitute professional advice and may not be relevant to your specific circumstances. Please always seek advice from a specialist and, of course, contact us via our website if you would like to discuss any of the subjects covered in more detail.
So the way that we incentivise people with equity is to give them the piece of paper.
Yep.
And they usually place high sentimental value on it, but would really like not to be taxed on it. And so the revenue say, well, the piece of paper is full of future hope and promise and things, and sometimes even inherently worth something already because the assets of a business are greater than its liabilities. Yep. And because it's profitable, or either of those two things. And so one of the things that we have a challenge or the friction is giving people the piece of paper, which they feel is a reward or a reason to stay, and the tax outcome of giving them the piece of paper. So if we just give them equity, they will be taxed on that if they don't pay the market value of the equity.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give them an option over equity, a promise of the future uplift in equity value, for example, what you end up with is the ability to defer the tax point. And in some cases, to make the tax better. So lots of share schemes are just about making the uplift better from a tax point of view,
okay,
from the employee's perspective. So typically, that would be an option to be able to buy a share at today's value in the future when it would be worth more. And the advantage commercially of an option is that you don't have to exercise it. So if it's worth less or about the same, you may not exercise your option. The tax advantages of options are frequently that you try and capture the today's value as your, if you like, base cost. And you get all of the future growth in value effectively as the shareholders do, as a capital sum. So you're aligning yourself with the shareholder from a tax point of view. Mm-hmm. And that marries in quite nicely with aligning yourself with the shareholder from an equitable point of view. You will be aligned with the shareholder's design for the business, for their potential future exit strategies. You'll be aligned on all of those things because of this option that you've got over equity. So that's quite a powerful thing for incentivizing a management team, for example. So share options are quite typically the way that people would do that. And that also gives the business a lot of flexibility because they will typically insist that options are only relevant while you're employed, for example. And the scheme that we see most often in the SME sector is the EMI scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And the scheme that we do the most work around is the EMI scheme. It's available to most businesses. What the revenue consider very safe businesses like accountants, law firms, property businesses, they can't use EMI. Because there's an excluded trading requirement. So there's excluded trades which are listed effectively in law. And there's also a size requirement. So you can be too big to be within the EMI scheme. One of the hardest hurdles for us sometimes is if people have lots of employees, but they're not necessarily valuable yet. If you have more than 250 employees, you're excluded.
Right.
So that's one of the tax, if you like, advantaged ways of giving equity, yeah, to people.
Are there any benefits through that scheme to the actual employer?
There are quite a few, actually. So other than kind of commercially not giving away equity, but giving away an option over equity, yeah, is quite a good thing commercially. Having that alignment of management is no doubt the reason for doing it. But if an employee is given share options, at the point that they exercise them, you typically get a deduction from your tax as if the inherent value of the option was something that you'd paid them for their services, even though it's not a cash item for the company. So on a sale, that's quite often missed as a real asset of the business, a tax asset, if you like. It's a deferred tax asset to be accounted for. So that's quite a big incentive for a client to look at giving options over equity rather than equity.
Yeah. I mean, you say there's the tax benefit. What is that? Is that a particular rate?
Yeah. So, well, at the moment, it's So the prevailing corporate tax rates, that's 19% at the moment. Yeah. So if, for example, we gave you a share option over 10,000 shares for £10,000, yeah, and in the future those 10,000 shares became worth £1 million, you'd exercise because it's valuable. You'd have to pay 10 grand, you get something worth £1 million.
Yeah.
You sell your million of shares for the £1 million. If structured, you know, in an advantageous way, like with EMI, the employer gets £990,000, the difference between what you paid and what they're worth, effectively as extra staff costs to offset against their profits for the year.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's worth a lot.
Yeah.
For the employee, you're delighted because you've got pretty much all of that at 10%. Yeah. We would expect it'd be quite usual for EMI people to qualify for entrepreneurs relief. Even if that goes, and there's suggestions that it might, it may be replaced by something which might align with it. And if it doesn't, capital gains tax is at 20%. There's no national insurance, so it's vastly different to your salary and the tax that you'd pay on a salary.
Am I right in assuming that when actually someone comes to exercise an option, the actual transaction is that actually the amount that they would pay is just deducted from the amount they receive rather than actually, does it have to be a physical trade of his, or I'm paying for the shares and getting the benefit back? Just in terms of, you know, if you are talking about 10,000, it's not necessarily something that someone has available to them as extra cash.
Yeah, it would be common for them to be cashless exercises if they're not in tax advantage schemes, because that makes economic sense. Where they are, it's very usual for people to be able to have access to short-term financing. That might be through the selling shareholders who are perhaps already wealthy people, or sometimes from institutions. You know, banks are quite alert to the fact that if you've got a pending sale for a business, and in your example, you're going to take £1 million, you have to find 10. They might take a little bit of an interest rate, but they will fund you the 10 in the expectation of the million coming in and you repaying them within a month or something like that. Often it happens on the same day.
Mm. I mean, you just mentioned that EMI is what we usually, what we typically use or our structure most frequently. Are there other similar schemes?
Yeah, so there are tax advantage schemes available to some very large corporates. So one's called a SIP, a share incentive plan, another save as you earn SAYE, which are effectively employees paying some money in, often quite frequently in an SAYE scheme. It would often be monthly. And that works very well in the sense that there are some tax advantages, like some extra shares or some discount or the ability to buy out of gross pay rather than net pay. But they're much smaller and typically they're much more expensive to operate those schemes. So certainly in the S bit of our market, and the M bit, if it qualifies for EMI will always outbid it, in the sense that it's relatively straightforward to set up and execute and implement and run. But those two schemes are available, and another one is called a company share option plan, a CSOP. And again, that has some limitations. And so it's typically not used. But where EMI isn't available, sometimes CSOP is. And in high growth businesses, getting any of the tax advantage schemes will work really well, because you're trading a large amount of upside for a good tax rate on it. So it's quite often the case that has merit to look at all four of those. There are other kind of non-legislated ways of achieving a similar thing. Often in property businesses or investment type companies, you have growth shares. So a class of share that looks like a piece of paper and a promise, but it has certain capital rights and restrictions over those. So if our business is worth 5 million, I might give you, 20% of the growth over 5.5 million. That isn't worth an awful lot today. And so the trick there is to get a low valuation for a growth share at the time and give you the piece of paper. But we all expect that if we do the things that we're planning to do, that will grow beyond the 5.5 million and you'll have a percentage of that.
Yeah.
And so that will flower in value, and that will be subject to capital gains tax usually. And that's what we try and do. They are sort of a flavour of the things that we do, as well as just simply giving shares outright to people.
Yeah.
Giving shares outright to people is often a challenge if the people don't work out.
Yes.
If the business doesn't work out, that's fine. None of the pieces of paper are worth much. If the people don't work out, you end up with people who own an interest in the business And the way that shareholders interact will be governed by the articles and the shareholders agreement, if there is one. And often they're not considered well, especially in startups. And so what we find is that you can end up with the position of the other shareholders having to buy out bad levers or having to kind of effectively premium to exit somebody over and above what you normally would just to exit a bad employee. That leaves a very bad taste in the mouth.
Are there things that can be put into the articles to actually make that easier?
Absolutely. Either in the articles or the shareholders' agreements, it would be incumbent on us to ensure that someone's taking good legal advice on them. And typically we'd work with the lawyers to make sure that there's no own goals in there. But from a legal point of view, it's far better to make sure the company and the other shareholders are protected than to deliver a tax advantage. So it all has to be weighed up.
I suppose one question is, you mentioned that, EMI is good for high growth businesses to appropriately incentivise staff. So there are circumstances when actually those sorts of schemes wouldn't be appropriate and actually wouldn't make economic sense.
Absolutely. So shareholders have to understand that they're giving away either some of today's value or tomorrow's value. That is only ever going to incentivize somebody if they can see that there will be today or tomorrow value. When they can't, so for example, businesses that aren't growing their value, if I give you the option to buy in at today's price and you can't see a way of us making today's price higher, that doesn't act as an incentive. So it would be far better to incentivize somebody with bonuses, albeit they're less tax efficient. They might get the behavior that is required in order to move the business forward. A combination of the two is quite often used. I find that people in sales roles are better incentivized with bonuses in cash rather than the promise of equity, unless it's a very high growth business or they're, very senior sales type person. That indicatively, when people start to talk to me about recruitment businesses, for example, we'll make sure that they're, that bonus structure that's in place is delivering for them first, unless they've got an obvious plan to sell or to grow value in excess of a typical recruitment business. That would be one where we'd say share incentives are no doubt good, but they should go hand in hand with making sure that people are appropriately rewarded for exceeding expectations operationally. That means that the equity is protected for the people that should benefit from it.
So what we're saying is that they work best in circumstances where the value is set to increase by however many folds.
Yes.
Obviously makes sense because someone's going to pay almost the same price for what they were given however many years ago. What's the typical time period of which somebody, when someone's given the options to exercise it, is there a standard or is it just depends on the business, depends on the employees?
I think that there's a little bit of friction here because it's always best for businesses to plan in advance. And in our firm, we do 3-year forward planning, if you like, on things like strategy and stuff. It is important to consider how people are incentivized to do the things that we want them to do over that period of time. And an EMI scheme, as an example, has a 10-year maximum. So the options must be exercisable within 10 years. If your plan is longer than 10 years, then of course, there won't necessarily be an event for you to get your reward. You might have to buy the shares and pay your 10,000 in the hope that you get your million in year 13. That's less of an incentive then. So there are occasions where there's kind of friction between that. Business is wanting to plan, wanting to give people a reason to stay, especially where they've not got the cash to be able to give them something else. But that the dilutive effect and the kind of time scales can put people off. You can also over incentivize people with equity, and if they don't perform, it's quite hard to get rid of them. Perhaps they're still required, but they're not doing everything you wanted. So it'd be quite common for us to insist on performance conditions. So your job is what you get paid for, and your shares will only be available to you under option if there's exceptional performance or as defined. And that can be a really powerful tool to get the best out of the best people, but also give you the opportunity to recycle the people's options that aren't performing well.
Because presumably think a lot of people fall into the belief that, you know, certain option schemes are very regimental in terms of this is how they apply, this is who they, you know, who they can apply to and what they need to look like. But what flexibility actually is there in terms of how we can design, you know, the advice that we give, you know, what flexibility or almost creativity to the employers have when they want to incentivize individuals as opposed to a group?
Well, the only real restriction in law will be dictated by the articles, yep, and what the directors can and can't do with the shares. Presuming that there's absolute flexibility there, there's absolute flexibility on equity-based remuneration and equity schemes. If the only frameworks that we try and deal with will be where we're trying to capture the advantage schemes. Mm-hmm. So where there's a framework in law, we work within that. But even within, and come back to EMI as an example, because it's very often used, you can draft in, you know, subject to some maximums and some time lengths and other things, you can draft in some pretty onerous requirements of the option holder. This is the company's entire discretion. So while they may not then act as the incentive and reward and retention tool you want them to, they can give you massive downside protection. We often have performance criteria, but also vesting conditions. So you can't immediately get all of the benefit of your shares if somebody comes along tomorrow and gives us an amazing offer, because we don't think that you will have earned them by then. So they can vest in tranches over periods of time. That's quite normal. And you can also make these things at the discretion of the board. So whether or not an option can be exercised could be subject to lots of conditions or at the discretion of the board. Okay. Perhaps the offer's so good, actually, we need that person to keep working for the next buyer, and we don't mind if they exercise them all and get their 50 grand or 100 grand. You know, it's a pretty small cost to keep the person there and happy.
Yeah.
So it does depend, but there's massive flexibility in these things.
What about incentives? We have an options pool where you have you've set aside a set percentage of shares that you're going to give to incentivize certain employees. Do you have the same flexibility?
You do and you don't. So a pool will often be created in like a fully diluted cap table where you've got institutional investors or more sophisticated investors sometimes. They'll say, we're willing to accept dilution, but only to this degree. Within that pool, you're really limited to understanding, okay, if we don't go out and raise any more money and we don't negotiate a different pool, we know that we've got, say, 10% of the business, where we want to get it to. And when you have shareholders like that, you'll have the plan of where you want to get it to and to grow to. You'll have some clarity over what the business needs to look like. And there'll be people that you don't even employ yet that you'll need to, and you need to keep some back for them.
Yeah.
So there's really limitations on how much dilution a shareholder will accept, and therefore how much reward you can possibly pump into the people that are going to be delivering shareholder value. I mean, effectively, the people on the ground are the ones delivering shareholder value.
Yes. But do they have that when someone's, you know, when you know that you need to keep some shares aside for future members of staff, those actual individuals and the vesting conditions and the incentives, can they still be designed for each person?
Yeah, absolutely. No, they'd often be to the person. There are some, like say, if you're desperate for tax advantages, and then you will be bound by the rules of law in that area. But, you know, I'll give you an example. Price Bailey's employee share ownership, you know, kind of plan, if you like, for want of a better word, is really just encouraging ownership. It's very ineffective from a tax perspective. There's no advantages at all. You know, we effectively gross up the value of the shares that we give to people after a year of service, and we pay their tax at their marginal rate for them. So they'll see it in their payslip. And that is a way of us saying, we fully accept that. We think that you should be an owner of the business, a part owner of the business. It's important to us. There are tax advantageous ways of doing that, but that we think they'd be more administratively cumbersome, and we'd be bound in a way that we don't want to be bound by that.
Yeah. So it comes down to culture and value rather than necessarily economic.
Absolutely. And tax shouldn't dictate the way that you do something. I mean, lots of these schemes are exceptionally well placed to help, especially SMEs. But you know, notwithstanding that fact, if it's not right, then you do something that is less tax advantageous but better commercially or culturally or, you know, whatever.
The aim of the schemes is, as you say, to provide, to incentivize and provide sort of future-proof the business, and they just so happen to be tax beneficial. It shouldn't be the primary reason for someone exploring this option, shouldn't be for the tax benefits.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely.
Are there other things that growing businesses and SMEs in particular need to consider when sort of exploring, or even once they know what scheme they want to implement, actually implementing it? So that things, for instance, like existing contracts or other agreements that are in place for exit routes.
One of the common issues that we come across is where they're relatively early stage businesses will have lots of contractors,
yep,
and they might offer them some level of equity,
mm-hmm,
and that's then they're not employees, you know, as a matter of fact, those people, and you know, some work is sometimes required to ensure that they are or aren't, but presuming, yeah, that they aren't, they won't fall in any of these tax advantage things, and indeed the tax outcome will usually fall on them as a consequence rather than the company. So it's really a commercial decision, but that's often a misconception that you can use these tax advantage schemes for people who aren't employees. Equally, you know, people that are resident elsewhere other than the UK, that if someone is tax resident in another jurisdiction, you've got a whole other layer of things to think about. So
they can still benefit from it, it's just more complicated.
Correct, yeah. Yeah. So we have clients who have employee share option schemes or ownership plans, and it is the same economic advantage to each employee, but depending on where they reside will depend on the tax outcome. So some people will do better and some people will do worse. And that is because of the tax regime in that jurisdiction, not because of the client. And that they perceive that as fairness. Others do what we call tax equalization. So they counter onerous tax regime and make sure that everyone gets the same amount net of tax. You know, both of those things are possible. So that's one hurdle. And another one is really on an exit, option holders, minority shareholders, the more people that you have that need to buy into the process to sign the SPA, who should give warranties and indemnities, yeah, things like that are never considered well enough in advance, frankly, you know, in my experience. And having people that aren't business-minded as equity owners, yeah, even on the day of the sale, can be challenging just emotionally and commercially.
Yeah.
So they are great things, but they need to, you know, kind of need to bear that in mind, mm-hmm, that you do need to, these people do need to be in the room. They might need to sign things. They might need to understand. They might have some obligations that they're unaware of. They need to contribute to legal fees. They can be quite substantial, and they won't necessarily all be people that are comfortable with that. I mean, lots of the sellers that we act for aren't anyway, but to add, yeah, to the mix, you know, people that really aren't necessarily entrepreneurs,
yeah, yeah,
that can be painful,
yeah,
for everyone involved. So while they're really good and the outcome is often great, and a month later when you look back you think, I'm really pleased we did, a week before you know, you might have gone significantly more grey than you otherwise would have done.
Can, or you mentioned about contracts there, can all employees benefit from incentives? You know, are they all transferred? Do they all qualify as?
Yeah, so most employees will be eligible. It needs to be the place that you work most or all of the time. So people who work only for a small amount of time in a week, but, you know, more or less wholly for, yeah, one employer, will be people that could qualify under EMI at least and other schemes.
It's not like an hours restriction, hours work restriction.
You know, there is a minimum working time requirement built into some of the regimes, right, but that's kind of counterbalanced with a percentage, yep, test as well. Usually, so, you know, in extreme cases, if you did 10 hours of work in a year, but you did 8 of them for your employer, then you could qualify still,
yep,
for example. You know, very unusual to get that sort of scenario, but we've seen cases not dissimilar. And I think while all employees could benefit from an equity scheme, I think that where you've got businesses that are growing well, they are the ones that should use it or should consider using it. And they should consider using it for the people who will deliver the growth in value. Yeah. Or all employee schemes will typically be, so there are other accountancy firms that have all employee schemes, like a share incentive plan, a SIP. It is relatively low. People that will need to be incentivized by these sorts of schemes aren't incentivized by a SIP.
Yes.
So it's a nice extra thing to have, and it's an efficient way of getting them some value at a relatively low tax rate. Perhaps it counterbalances slightly poorer salaries or something like that, but it won't have the potential upside that somebody that is going to be really valuable to a firm is going to be able to deliver. So
it's not highlighting key employees that it's a recognition, is it?
Yeah, so often you'll find people that want to reward loyalty, which is very important, and especially where they haven't been able to pay what they perceive to be full market rates for people, they might recognise that with share options, which will keep the people there, and maybe they're still not being paid exactly what they could get elsewhere.
Yep.
So that can be a powerful tool. But I would say if you have remunerated them appropriately for what they have done, then focus options on what you will do or the future growth. And that's an expectation not only of you just doing your job, which we will pay people for, but for you, you know, delivering clever ideas or, you know, operational excellence or something that's going to deliver value to the business in the long term, and saleable value as well. You know, that's crucial to work back from. How do we become worth the million from the 10,000, and who's contributed to that? Your shareholders are always willing to dilute where people are adding more to the whole pot, in my experience at least.
You mentioned there about being about the future. I can't remember for which client there was a distinction between, you know, the best option depends on whether you're trying to thank them for something that they've already done or incentivize them for future things. Are there different mechanisms?
Yeah, so one of the ways that we built in, I remember the case exactly. So one of the ways that we built that in was to say that the price that they pay, so what's the strike price for the thing? So if the HMRC typically, and this was an EMI scheme, so you can get a pre-option valuation check with the revenue that they, in this case, had said, you know, I can't remember exactly, so say 10p per share. So they accept that for a minority of shares, the total value of the business is worth X, but the minority would be worth a discount of that, especially where there's no dividends being paid. There's no real prospect of any value to a person holding a share, and thus the shares are worth less. If you have somebody that has already contributed, then you might give them the shares for 5p or 10p, this lower minority, you know, heavily discounted price. You could contrast that with somebody who you've taken on to grow it to be worth more than 50p a share. And so you have to buy them for 50p. Their shares are currently what we'd describe as underwater. There's no prospect that anybody would ever pay 50p per share for something that's worth 5p or 10p per share. But they might have the incentive or the ability to grow it to 55p a share, and then they would buy. That, you know, is one of the ways that you can build in that hurdle into an options arrangement. And that was exactly that. There were many staff who would get a small amount, low price, and there were some new people who were, you know, high flyers or directors or prospective value adders that were going to get much more of the pie, but over a certain price.
Yeah.
I think they came in at the same price the investors invested at.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and that's the thing, is one thing I know we've had to explain to clients a couple of few times, that the valuation on sort of share options is or can be different to the valuation on a minority investment for just a shareholder who's going to, you know, purchase shares, as well as it being different to the valuation if you're selling the whole business.
Yeah, that's right. So, the price of the next bit of equity is, you better describe it than me, but the price of the next bit of equity can be really expensive if we desperately need the money and we can't borrow it, or quite cheap if we can fund ourselves and we're actually returning money to shareholders, then, you know, there's no real requirement for extra equity. So the next bit of equity, you know, economically isn't, you know, won't come with a high cost of capital. But when you look at tax valuations, and that might be for share options, or it might be on death, or it might be on a gift of shares between family members, you approach the valuations in very different ways, and the revenue are willing to accept the whole value of the business, as long as it's not for sale or listed on a market where you can easily sell the shares. There's a huge discount for the fact that they're not marketable. There's probably something in an agreement that says that you can't market it to anybody. Everyone else has preemption rights. They're able to buy them off of you pro rata to their shareholdings if you want to sell them first. There might even be a valuation that's dictated if it's not a sale event. So it would typically be the case that there's a much lower current value of those shares, even if commercially, you know, in the theoretical world of you and corporate finance, it could be sold for 10 million. You may find, you know, disappointingly for some shareholders, when they read my valuation, it says a much lower number.
Yeah. The amount of panic you get when people see that.
Yeah.
Why is such a difference?
And there's not often an easy bridge, but it's a number of things and, restrictions, limitations, expectation.
Yeah, minority interest base.
Lack of marketability, you know, the fact that shareholders wouldn't sell for 10 million doesn't mean it's worth 10 million now. They just know that that's what they will exit for, and they understand how they can get there. That, you know, that level of clarity is fantastic, and communicating that to staff will help, but it doesn't mean that it's worth that either now, or certainly for a minority now.
Yes.
No one will do that. Equally with investors, they get confused about their equity investment of say 5% versus 5% of share options for someone in the business.
Yeah.
And the difference of valuation there, while you have to explain it, it's typically accepted that people will pay a premium for newly issued shares because they might, for example, qualify for EIS.
Yes.
Or an investor has chosen to deploy because they believe in that future, and they're paying effectively a premium to join the ride, knowing that it can grow, and that then they're a non-participator usually. And so if you contrast that with an employee, you know, they might reasonably say, well, it won't be worth that if I don't come and do what I'm telling you I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Their minority is clearly worth far less. They don't get the tax incentive on investment, and the company needs to incentivize that person. So, you know, even economically, you can see why there'd be a different price for the same thing.
Yeah.
Even though ultimately they will become the same thing, no doubt.
Yeah. There was also the example where they wanted to give non-exec directors share options. Is that, again, something you see?
Yeah, that would be quite usual. Again, usually in lieu of receiving appropriate remuneration for a non-exec role. If we get in early enough that the discussions are around appointment of non-execs and equity, it'd be quite common to be able to get them an incentive like under EIS.
Yes.
Where the real incentive is the tax-free capital gain at the end.
Yeah.
Albeit
they can't get if they've been given options.
Correct. So, you know, the best outcome you'll get is capital gains tax at the prevailing rates of probably 20 or 10.
Yeah.
That's the best answer. So zero is obviously a lot better than that. And most people are really unfamiliar about how they might go about doing that. But non-execs are a really good example of people. They've usually got some capital behind them. That's usually why they're taking the appointment anyway. That's not something they're relying upon for income. And so they would more neatly be aligned with the shareholder anyway. They're kind of a shareholder that will participate a bit.
Yes. So
they will be invited to equity because of that, but they will potentially be able to get investor type reliefs as almost like a business angel rather than an employee type relief, which will align them with an ordinary shareholder like an entrepreneur, but it won't give them an investor type relief because that's not the character of what they are. And if you square that off, it sort of is fairly logical the way that the reliefs for an investor will be different to the reliefs for an entrepreneurial, you know, founder and people who have been able to come in on an equity incentive arrangement, they might be taxed differently again.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk, and I've done, as you know, a separate recording on EOTs, but in particular from the perspective of EOT as an alternative to a sort of traditional MBO. How do EOTs differ from what we're talking about here?
So employee ownership trusts are really where you're placing the control of the business at the disposal of the employees. And while there's some scope to that to be unequal in a way, it's really saying that, you know, the control bit's the really important word.
Right.
With equity incentivizing, you're almost always, you know, you might give up to control away, but you'd always typically retain it.
You know,
whoever we is, it might be the shareholders, the founders, you know, it might be institutional money, someone will obtain or retain control, notwithstanding they're happy to give away a piece. EOTs really flip that on its head and say, we need at least 51% to qualify under that arrangement. And in my experience, it works quite well for mature businesses rather than high growth businesses. The John Lewis model works really well because they are sharing the profits after staff costs with the shareholders, most of whom, or in fact all of whom in their case, are the staff really. And you can link that to salary and things like that. So that is a really good way of that mature business delivering to its stakeholders, and indeed employees and shareholders are one and the same thing. With an EOT, it's very similar to that. You need to make sure that, you know, just from a governance perspective, that the people who are doing the valuable roles are remunerated through the payroll for doing the valuable roles, because they can't obtain that kind of equitable premium that you might expect in a high growth business with share options or something like that in an EOT type arrangement. So it will differ from the way that a lot of owner managed businesses have operated in the past. Perhaps they've gone with a slightly higher dividend and a lower salary. Perhaps they've not taken any remuneration at all. Perhaps they've not charged the business for rent of a premises that they own. In an EOT situation where you lose control to the employees, that might be considered actually that you should be operating at market value to give the shareholders the true kind of economic profit share, rather than one that is effectively manipulated via not charging the right salary or rent or, you know, whatever.
And it's an all employee scheme.
So the trust exists for the benefit of all employees, very widely drafted, and is just a different type of operating model that isn't really about incentivizing.
Have you had people thinking that it's a great way to sort of try and show to your employees that you're wanting them to have a say in, you know, the future of the business, but actually it's not quite designed.
Yeah, I think we've managed to put a few people off of it just because of the understanding of control and what that means.
Yeah.
But one of the real red herrings in the laws on EOT is this sort of $3,500 tax-free, you know, bonus arrangement. People assume that is some reason to do it, and it's just an outcome of doing it. You shouldn't ever give away control of your business in order to remunerate some people in a tax efficient way, unless your goal was to give away control of your business, in which case that's a really clever thing to do.
Exactly.
So I think that people misread or misunderstand it, but fortunately I think lots of advisors are either, because it's relatively new, they're either familiar that they're unfamiliar with it, or that, and indeed the way that it's done with a trust is such that you really do require a lawyer, and that they're brilliant at thinking about the worst case scenarios, where we might be a bit more excited about the tax stuff. You know, we would say that we won't be, and we're very commercial, but you can't promise that of all advisors or us every single day. and so, you know, it's good to have two professionals in there, and to go through them. And the more that you do of them, the more you realize that they're exceptionally powerful for some things, but equity incentives and high growth businesses, necessarily the places that I would put that at the top of the list.
No, that makes sense. I think a lot of the time people come to various different tax schemes for the wrong reasons, and it doesn't necessarily mean they can't access it, whatever it is, whether it's employee incentives or otherwise. It doesn't necessarily mean they can't access some tax benefits. It just might be it's a different one. It depends on the needs of the business.
Yeah, you'd always want to look at the objectives of the business, of the shareholders. When you're looking at equity, the shareholders obviously need their consent and approval for such things, and whether or not that's a reasonable expectation and objective, bearing in mind where they are now. And then we might recommend something that will work economically or commercially. And then we might say, and if we tweaked it a little bit, you'd lose a little bit of that objective, but it would be more tax efficient for the employees. What do you think? And I think if you approach it the other way around and say there's some incentives here, let's try and get them, you very rarely meet what are your wider objectives. In a lot of ways, that's why we have the share scheme we have, which is described as inefficient. You know, it gives effectively, you know, is an extra equity partner around the table called our staff. And you know, that's really important culturally and from the business's point of view,
notwithstanding
that the tax outcome is well, it's fairly painful for us on the way in, and the benefits of owning one equity partner's stake with 400 of your colleagues is that you don't receive a great deal in isolation. You know, the equity partner receives quite a bit, but divide it by a lot of people and you get very little. So the return is exceptional because it costs nothing and you get a return. But the it is not an incentive in the sense that it will retain people or reward them for something. It's really the gesture and the cultural purpose of it that's overriding, and that's intentional on our part, and why we didn't go down a route that was more tax effective, which we could have done.
Are there other examples of that? Or is that
I think it's quite
different circumstances.
Yeah, it can be quite common to have bad tax outcomes. You know, examples where EMI isn't available. You might find that we talk through the growth shares, and that isn't palatable for whatever reason, and sometimes they're good reasons, like I don't think a buyer will understand this, or we're worried that the business doesn't understand it well enough, or that we give too much away or too little. We're going to give somebody shares in the business, accepting that they'll have an income tax liability, and knowing that we're going to have to probably give them a bonus in order to cover it, which is a real grossing up exercise, and effectively, you know, is a large cost to the business. But that might just be the right thing, because perhaps they've already earned it, or it was a promise that was made some time ago, or, you know, for lots of different reasons. And sometimes it's business succession. That might just be the right thing to do. So it isn't uncommon to end up with the tax person saying, well, you know, it would have been nice to have done it a better way. But everybody else thinking, well, actually, we're quite chuffed with it. And I think that's just one of the facts of life, that tax is really an outcome thing. It shouldn't really drive much, and government uses tax to drive behaviours to some extent, but we try not to let it govern what our clients do.
Okay. thank you
very much for listening.
If you have any comments, thoughts or questions about today's session, or would like our support in helping your business to grow, please do feel free to contact us on our website at www.pricebailey.co.uk. Thank you.